Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. It's sometimes called brown envelope journalism. This is the practice of journalists taking money or gifts from companies, politicians, even international charities to give them favorable news coverage. Payola, as it's often called in this country, has long been a problem in journalism in countries all around the world. But it's particularly a problem in developing nations, where journalists are sometimes paid just a few dollars a day with the understanding that they can supplement their income by taking money from those they write about. But payola isn't uniquely a problem in developing nations. It's also an issue for journalists in the U.S. and other wealthy democratic nations, especially those who do business journalism or work that involves reviewing products and services. So on this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to learn more about this payola phenomenon. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from a former editor at several popular tech news sites in New York about his experience with this. But first, we're going to take a look at the issue of payola for journalists in Africa, where the practice sometimes takes place in plain sight. In Ghana, this is sometimes called soli or solidarity money for journalists. In Tanzania, it's called kitu kidogo. In the Congo, it's called le coupage, or literally the cut. So for more on this, we're going to bring in a journalist who's been following this issue closely. Joining us from Monrovia, Liberia, is Jefferson Krua of the news site The Bush Chicken. Jefferson, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I mean, first off, tell us about your news organization, The Bush Chicken. This is a fairly new news startup that you co-founded in part to address some ethical problems with the media in Liberia.
Yes. So I started this organization out of frustration with what was currently on the market. You have situation where journalists will always get money from sources. There was blackmailing going on. There's a lot of blackmailing always goes on.
Blackmailing. So you mean journalists would say, like, we have some negative information about you that we're going to print unless you pay me some money or pay my news organization some money?
Yes, is a fairly common practice. Or on the flip side, people will come and offer media outlets funds to either not publish a story or to publish a particular story and not let people know the source. So a lot of these issues were what motivated me to start this news outlet. And we also, our name is reflective of our goal of also being in rural areas, because most of the time, only news from the capital city of Monrovia is, it's that gets out to the public. So that's why, we sometimes get news from, the rural areas, and other places.
Okay. So the Bush Chicken. So you are trying to report news that's happening in the bush in the rural areas then.
Talk to us
about this issue of payment to journalists. It sounds like so some of this that happens probably takes place like behind closed doors, but it also sounds like in Liberia sometimes sort of payments to journalists from their sources happens quite openly. Talk to us about that.
The vast majority of it happens out in the open. I'll give you a story of when I first moved back, and I was covering a story at the Ministry of Commerce, and after the whole conference finished, I saw the minister left, and then one of the employees came out with a bag full of cash, and I was just looking around, just a little shocked that it was like so open.
Okay, so wait, so what did the journalists do when this Ministry of Commerce staffer came out with a bag full of cash?
They already knew what to do. They just crowded up around him. That's when I really learned more about how common this practice was. They actually have sheets at every press conference or some event where the person giving out the news wants coverage. They would have like a sheet of the journalist, so the journalist can put their name down, the institution, and then check off that they receive money. So it's so open that there's records.
And how much payment are we talking about?
So I mean, it can vary depending on the organization. That time when I was at the Commerce Ministry, what I saw them collecting was about $20. And so $20 is a lot of money. That amount is actually, they call it transportation, but $20 is way more than that. I spent a dollar or less on transportation that day to and from that event.
Okay, so it's sort of being given out under the fiction that this is to cover your transportation expenses to get from your news agency's office to the press conference at the government ministry, but in fact it's several multiples of what you'd ever actually spend on that. But $20 can be quite a significant sum. What are salaries like for most journalists in Liberia?
So, and there's the challenging issue with this, because a lot of publications don't pay their reporters very well. Some will pay $40, some might pay $150 or so a month.
$150 a month. So if you can get $20 for showing up to one press conference, and you can do several press conferences a week or even a couple a day, there's a big incentive to do that. Okay.
And it kind of skews where the news is coming from, right? So because you have a lot of these people who are putting on press conferences and paying money, and they get to control the news that gets out.
Okay, so obviously this is affecting how the journalists are reporting on the news. When the Minister of Commerce gives this speech or has this press conference, it doesn't sound like there's going to be much critical coverage of what he says afterwards if everyone is taking money.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't, it's not to say that some people wouldn't collect the money and still provide somewhat critical coverage, but I mean, it's human nature to reciprocate, and generally you don't expect that. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, so just for a little bit of context here, so Liberia went through absolutely horrific civil war in the 1990s, early 2000s. It is a post-conflict society, and there are a lot of aid organizations and international organizations that work in Liberia. Do some international organizations also do this?
The vast majority of them do it, because this system has been built now where journalists expect this. So you don't want journalists to know that you're one of those people who don't, one of those organizations that don't dole out cash for journalists attending. Otherwise, people would just not even bother going to your event.
So it's almost like it's almost embedded in the media culture there now. And so even organizations that work in a bunch of different countries and wouldn't do this in other places do it in Liberia.
Oh yeah, very much. International organizations that you're all familiar with.
Okay, well, how does the Bush Chicken address this then? Like, how do you prevent your reporters from taking part in this? I mean, what's the answer?
So, first of all, it's a two-step approach. We really have extremely stringent requirements. Number one, I'm always, both me and other leaders of the organization, we're always, you know, speaking about how this is a practice that we do not do, and inviting anybody who spots one of our reporters doing so to, come and report this to us. And we also get that message to these reporters that there will be serious actions taken against you if we have people proving that this is what's happening. But then we have to follow that up and actually pay them a decent wage. Right now we're paying slightly above average, it's my goal that we can, you know, ideally I would like for all of my reporters to be making at least $500 a month, because I think, having lived here, I think that's a livable wage. Monrovia is quite expensive, and, you know, people who are making only $150 a month, I can see how they can actually survive without supplementing their income in some other way. So we combine, you know, these strong directives with trying to pay them better to ensure that we can we have them working.
Well, Jefferson, sorry, I want to come back to this issue first, but first we need to take a break to remind our listeners that they're tuned in to Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the issue of payola in journalism, the practice of companies or politicians offering journalists money or gifts in return for positive news coverage. We just have been speaking with Jefferson Krua of the Bush Chicken in Liberia. To take a closer look closer to home now, we're going to hear about how this sometimes happens in the United States. And for that, we're going to bring in John Biggs in New York. He's a former editor at some popular tech news sites like Gizmodo and TechCrunch. His work has also appeared in the New York Times and Wired. And he now writes about cryptocurrencies for the news site CoinDesk. John, welcome.
Howdy, howdy. Yeah, hi.
Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. You, as I mentioned, you had been an editor and a writer for these popular tech sites like TechCrunch, Gizmodo, and I understand that you've been you get approached by companies with some frequency to offering payment. Talk to us about how this happens.
Sure, for quite a while. It hasn't happened recently. Maybe the crypto world is different slightly, but over at TechCrunch, they would offer. They wanted to publish news pieces, right? So they would write up something and try to send it to you and say, hey, can we pay you to publish this, or can we pay you to write about us? My joke was always to ask for something like astronomical, like $10,000 or whatever, and then go up as they got angry when it seemed like they would.
Well, wait a minute. Like, what kinds of companies would be doing this? Like, they want you to publish their sort of article or advertise under your byline.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a certain subset of the PR public relations industry. Most public relations is basically just email a journalist. If the journalist likes it, they write it. If they don't like it, then they ignore it, et cetera, et cetera. This was sort of like a guerrilla, I guess you could say, situation where smaller companies that might be outside of the U.S. Wanted some attention. And those are the PR agencies that would come in and ask you for this.
Okay, so they would have their own. So they're PR agencies that actually kind of like specialize in doing this.
I guess so. I guess specialize in payola. I suppose they're mostly young guys, essentially, which is the only overarching connection that I've seen.
Well, so how much money would they offer you?
They would offer something like $200. So it would be like, can you post this news for $200, and then I would raise it to something completely astronomical just for kicks.
Okay, and so the news would be something about like how the problem that this company's product solves is important, and by the way, you can buy this great product that solves the problem from such and such website, right?
Okay.
It's
like one step away from like astroturfing for like completely paying for what looks like organic traffic and is actually just advertisements.
Okay, so the advantage to the company then is it looks like they're getting sort of earned publicity, like you've actually tried their product, think it's a great product, solves an important or real problem, and are writing about it when in fact it's just like a deceitful advertisement then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, what about, talk to us, I understand part of the goal for some of these companies is actually like more than sort of traditional publicity, it's actually like search engine results.
Yeah, there are some aspects of search engine optimization. So as long as the keyword is in there, what they like to do is they like to put a link attached to their product to like a special keyword. So if your product, I don't know, cures baldness and you do a they do a post about baldness, that the link is constantly connected to that baldness word in the post. That way, that kind of fools Google and other search engines. At this point in the game, all that's kind of been sniffed out by now, so it's a little bit silly. But that sort of snake oil, as they call it, the SEO snake oil, has always been a popular moneymaker for folks.
Okay, and so what types of media organizations are getting targeted by this?
Almost everybody. Everybody at TechCrunch would constantly get targeted for this. I think there's also a situation where you do have a country maybe like Liberia or maybe even a Russia or a China where it's kind of used. It's kind of common for this to happen, and they kind of expect it to happen elsewhere, and especially in America. And there's also I've also spoken with people who believe that that's the way journalism is going. So there's no reason to fight it. So there are organizations out there that are doing this fairly actively, pay-to-play sort of stuff. And you can, those pop up every once in a while when I try to reach out to somebody or something, and they basically do an automatic response, an automatic bounce back for their email that says, hey, we can write about you for $200 or something like that.
Yeah, and I understand that there had actually been some of these news sites that had sort of opened their platforms up to have lots of contributors writing for them. Mm-hmm. I know have been particularly vulnerable to this. There have been a few different scandals at different places in the last couple of years. Talk to us about that.
So you have your Fortunes, you have your, I think it was Inc. and a couple other magazines that basically just created sort of a blogging platform for
Forbes,
whole world.
Forbes, right? Yeah.
Forbes, that's right. Yeah, so you have this massive thing. Huffington Post was supposed to be something similar. But when you give the entire world access to a publishing platform, the vast majority of people aren't going to use it, and most marketers are. Another interesting thing that I found a few years ago was that Harvard and MIT and a few other companies, or a few other universities, actually had wide open blog platforms. So if you were a university professor, you could basically get in there and you could create your own blog, WordPress blog, and just spin it up. You just press a button and it would run. And what was happening is you would have these folks who would kind of steal a blog from someone or get a blog from someone, and they would actually post it under an MIT or a Harvard or a Yale URL, which would give a little bit of credence to their news. If you were smart, you understood that it was basically just some kind of spammy marketing thing. But if you weren't, if you just looked at it briefly and you said, oh, these guys got written up in Yale, then that might have given you a benefit. I was actually able to shut that down by writing about it, because it was really, really silly.
Well, that's interesting. But I think, you know, one aspect of this, you mentioned that you get offered $200 sometimes. I mean, that's real money, especially for people maybe who are freelancers and only maybe making $100-$200 a day writing. Like, people go for this.
People do. It's wildly unethical and it's dangerous, because it could basically knock out your entire career. But if that's how you want to fly, that's how you fly. There are a bunch of sites that do this, and it's sad but true. Ideally, none of the sites that I work for or try to edit would ever do this. But it sometimes happens. You sometimes have a situation where somebody asks for something in exchange for a post, for example, and that's not nice, and that's not a great thing to do. And I think only by talking about it and only by exposing it, which is one of the things that I like to do, is how we win.
Well, I understand that one of your side projects is actually writing about luxury watches, and it sounds like there's just ethical problems around payola are rampant in sort of how news organizations write about luxury goods. Talk to us about that.
Well, I mean, it's not like if I miss a scoop on a luxury watch, it's not like the end of the world. So it's not political, it's not health, it's not science, etc. But what happens a lot of the time in these industries is that you either have sort of a guest post written by the brand that now most recently has been posted and shown and confirmed that it's sponsored, but in the past wasn't. And in some cases, you could actually buy the covers of magazines. And you could buy inside coverage. So if you had a brand new watch coming out, you could get it on the cover of one of these magazines, the luxury magazines, and pay for it. And that sort of pay for play has been fairly rampant for decades, and nobody really talks about it, because I mean, this is not we're not life and death situation here. If you find out if there's a new purse or whatever, but it's still important consideration, because if you can't pay to get into the cover of Watch Time magazine or whatever, one of these sites, one of these services, then your watch or your luxury good just disappears.
A quick reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist, you can check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. On today's show, we've been talking about the problem of payola in journalism, and we've heard about how these bribery offers to journalists in Africa and to journalists in business news are more common than you might expect. For a closer look at the implications of this issue now, we're going to bring Paul Fletcher into the conversation. He's a former president of the Society for Professional Journalists and sits on the organization's ethics committee. He's also the editor of a number of legal publications, including Virginia Lawyers Weekly. He joins us now from Richmond. Paul, welcome.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, hey, no, it's a pleasure to have you. Talk to us. I mean, first, just tell us, how does the Society for Professional Journalists, one of the biggest journalism organizations in the U.S., how do they look at this issue?
Well, I would turn to our Code of Ethics, which you referenced a minute ago. The Code of Ethics from SPJ has been around since the 20s. It's considered the, more or less the gold standard for a lot of different ethics codes that are out there. You'll find it taught in a lot of schools, and it will not come as a surprise that the ethics code is going to find what you've been describing to be unethical. And the way that the code puts it is that journalists should refuse gifts, favors, fees, free travel, and special treatment that may compromise integrity or impartiality or may damage credibility. And I think John put his finger right on it. A minute ago is that, you know, this is, it's just not a good idea for any number of reasons. One is that your reputation will be absolutely shot if it gets out that you've been on the take on the side. And more than that, your publication or anybody that you work for is going to be looked at unfavorably as well.
What about, I think you heard our conversation with Jefferson Crew, what about the special problems that exist maybe in places where journalists are paid really, really low salaries? News organizations just don't have much budget.
Well, I understand that, and I salute Jefferson for trying to fight against that that trend over in Liberia. I think that's a problem here because, you know, journalist salaries aren't the highest in the United States. There are a lot of people who've been laid off and who are freelancing. So I can understand. You know, you got to put food on the table, you got to pay the rent. But at the same time, if you're serious about being a journalist, you want to protect your name. And more importantly, you want to protect your standing. It's interesting that you mentioned Forbes. For a couple of years, I was a contributor or a blogger for Forbes.com, and in preparation for this this program, I went back and looked at my old contract, and you are required to let Forbes know if you have any financial interest, quote-unquote, in anything you write, which, you know, I would read to include, you know, taking a couple hundred bucks to talk about or write about a given product or whatever. So you stand to lose your job or to lose your gig and would have a hard time explaining that to the next employer.
Well, that makes sense. Jefferson Crew, if I could bring you back in, you heard Paul Fletcher talking about the Code of Ethics at the Society for Professional Journalists. I mean, are these same standards, do you think they're always applicable in the context of a place like Liberia, or is it, I mean, is there obviously lots of things that are just different about being a reporter in Liberia?
The interesting thing is there's also the Press Union of Liberia has very similar code of ethics as that. It's just that nobody follows it. But I think he touched on something. It's if you're serious about your profession, then you should certainly, these are principles that you should follow, or else then you shouldn't call yourself a journalist.
Well, Paul, what about some of the issues that John Biggs touched on, especially when it comes to reviewing products and services? This seems like a particularly problematic area, and as there's been this sort of information explosion online, it seems like there are these ethical problems are only becoming broader.
Well, I think you, unfortunately, are correct, because people are going to realize, you know, the companies that have these things think they can buy their way into coverage, and with the internet, it's worldwide. There are any number of channels of distribution of information. Even in my field, you know, legal journalism, I know there's one company that literally is pay to play. It's a glossy magazine that publishes profiles of attorneys to say, if you're interested in having us write about you, contact us, and we'll quote you a rate. Essentially, that's not verbatim, but that's the clear implication, so that you get your name in this thing.
Okay, and then this is useful for lawyers because they can say, you know, look, I was profiled or I was called the best lawyer and such in this magazine, and I can use that in my business and my marketing.
Well, yeah, is that they would probably, you know, get a PDF reprint and post it on their website and talk all about it. But the thing I go back to is that, you know, people who read those things know what they are, and they know that they're not serious. They know that they are what they are, which is.
But it wouldn't exist if it wasn't useful in some way to some people. But John Biggs, let me bring you back into this then, because I know when you had been talking with one of our producers, you mentioned your coverage of luxury watches, and you were talking about how actually a lot of these watches, these products are released at events that are in locations that are quite exotic or expensive, and literally you can't get access to the news about some of these products without going to these locales. How does that play out?
I mean, usually they email you and say, hey, we're going to fly you out to Monaco to ride in a supercar or whatever, and then have dinner and then look at a watch and then fly you back. Sounds fun, right? But that's the only way to get access to a new watch in that front. There are sort of watch shows, I guess you could go to, and a lot of those are actually paid for. I don't want to single out luxury. It's an entirely different market than we're talking about here, but it's one of the most egregious situations. There used to be a lot more of the payola or basically free flights and all that other good stuff in the technical world, the tech journalism world. When I first started at Gizmodo, probably in around 2003, 2004, they were flying everybody everywhere to Korea, to Japan.
Review our new phone. These kinds of
things,
the new
right? phone, meet the design team in Seoul, for example, that sort of thing. But we quickly squashed that. Most of the tech blogs that replaced the magazines basically said, we're not going to do this anymore. And it essentially stopped for all intents and purposes.
Well, I'm sorry to cut you off here, John, but our time is growing short. Paul, I want to give you the last word to you. Where do you see this issue moving over the next few years? Is there is there reason for optimism that this issue is going to diminish over time, or do you see it continuing to grow?
I would hope. I guess I'll choose to be an optimist about this, Jason, of where people who are serious, and I think all three of us on the program would agree on this, people who are serious about this aren't going to want to participate in it. If you want to make a living as a journalist, if you want to make a name as a journalist, you're not going to go near this, because the ultimate thing that you have is your reputation, and you have the trust of the people that you write for, and you guard that very jealously.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Jefferson Crua, Kennedy Abueo, John Biggs, and Paul Fletcher. Our assistant producers this week are Molly Jackson, Kyle Lahusik, and Francesca Stottlemyre, with supervising producer Rosie Belson. Megan Smaltz is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.